Today, wages crunch ahoy! The DFA Daily to the 10th of March 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Well, wages growth is frankly derisible at the moment, with data from the ABS showing an average 1.4% annual rise, although of course it's lower in the private sector. And CPI, while volatile, is eroding real incomes, and many have not had any meaningful increase for years. Contrast that with corporate profits, which have been growing very nicely, thank you, not least because of the government's JobKeeper, or should we say ProfitKeeper, perhaps, scheme. Now, the RBA is much exercised about wages growth momentum, which of course has been abysmal for years. In their statement on November the 3rd last year, which was supported by the first RBA press conference in living memory, Dr. Lowe said wage growth will have to be materially higher than it is currently for inflation to be sustainably within the 2-3% target band. And he has actually repeated that pretty much every month since then. So, Alan Kohler wrote in the New Daily, perhaps the RBA Governor, Philip Lowe, will be hoping that when Christian Porter returns to work from mental health leave, he forgets to bring his industrial relations bill with him. The legislation actively, intentionally undermines what Dr. Lowe is trying to achieve. It is one of many ways in which the federal government is trying to get wages growth down. Both of them launched after the RBA produced its big effort in November to get wages growth up. Porter revealed his forthcoming industrial relations omnibus bill on December the 9th, 2020. He presented the bill as a series of improvements to the IR system, simplifying awards, ending the confusion around the status of casual employees, boosting investment in mega projects, and simplifying the Better Off Overall Test, or the BOOT test, in awards and enterprise agreements, which says that new arrangements must always leave workers better off. But the bill does far more than simplify and clarify. It actually introduces a pathway for employers to cut unions out of enterprise agreements, which Porter claims will help increase the coverage of enterprise agreements from the current 11.7%, and in 2013 it was at 19%. But non-union EAs almost always involve lower wages than deals involving unions. And this is why the government wants to cut out the unions. The bill also reduces scrutiny by the Fair Work Commission so that lower wage arrangements can be approved more quickly. The protections in the Fair Work Act are the last line of defence for employees who have been handed out a pro forma contract and told to sign it. The bill introduces a two-year exemption to the BOOT test, but it will effectively last longer than this because EAs typically keep going until they're renegotiated, which often takes years. In effect, the government is destroying the safety net that says wages cannot be reduced in Australia. And another downforce is a wage cut for Commonwealth public servants, unveiled by the Assistant Minister to the Prime Minister and Cabinet, Ben Morton, back in November 2020. And of course, they made that in the clear knowledge of the RBA statement just 10 days earlier. It's a deliberate repudiation by the government of monetary policy. Morton announced that the existing 2% cap on wage increases for public servants would be removed and that future increases would be limited to those in the private sector, as measured by the ABS's Wage Price Index, the WPI. It was presented as a way for public servants to get pay rises of more than 2%. Morton said it could happen when private sector wage growth eventually exceeds 2%, which is probably why it didn't get much attention at the time. But right now, the WPI is just 1.4%. So the new policy is a cut from the previous 2%. It's simple, really. If the government was interested in helping the Reserve Bank, it would increase public service wages. That would set a benchmark for the rest of the workforce. And the decision to cut them instead came just 10 days after the RBA announced this historic set of measures designed to get wages growth up. It cut the cash rate, of course, from 0.25% to 0.1% and launched quantitative easing for the first time by saying that it would buy billions and billions worth of government bonds. As if government policy wasn't doing enough to reduce real take-home wages, we're doing it to ourselves as well. Workers are wary of asking for a pay rise or switching jobs to attain it. As Michael Pascoe, again in the New Daily, said, there's another factor working to suppress Australian wages, fear. According to a specialist finance and tech recruiting agency, people are putting a premium on keeping whatever job they have because of the employment uncertainty created by COVID. For others, the rush to load up on cheap debt is underlining the need for stable employment. The end result is employees unwilling to rock the boat or chance a change of employer. Robert Half, director of John O'Leary, mentioned the stability premium insight as part of a broader discussion. It was one of the findings to come out of research from the firm's annual salary guide, which will be published in full next week. The good news is that O'Leary expects employers to have to pay more to recruit new staff to lure them away from their existing jobs, the stability premium. The bad news, while there are exemptions, there's little sign of employers wanting to pay their existing staff much more. If a new recruit turns up in your office doing the same job as you, and no better, maybe worse, odds are new colleagues will be paid substantially more than you are. That's long been the case, but it looks like the size of the differential is going up. No wonder employers tend to insert a clause in contracts forbidding employees from discussing their pay with colleagues. And Treasury analysis 2 years ago showed Australians were changing jobs less often. Our national job switching rate has fallen to 8% from 11% in the early 2000s. And it seemed every 1% fall in the job switching rate results in 0.5% reduction in wages growth. And in the real world of non-award wages, salary packages include superannuation as part of the total, not something separate. If the government keeps its legislative promise to increase the super guarantee in the new financial year by 0.5%, then it will be factored into new or renegotiated packages. For those on awards, the super lift might well be the only increase they get this year. In fact, weak wages growth is probably our biggest domestic economic problem. Wages increase only matching the inflation rate actually mean lower living standards, as the after-tax, after-welfare result is substantially less than inflation. Greater awareness about changing jobs threatens to make a bad situation worth thinking about a few weeks after the Reserve Bank began its own bid to get wages up, including, of course, that bond buying programme. Meanwhile, in the US, Amazon embarked on an advertising blitz urging Congress to follow its lead and raise the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour US to $15 US. Amazon increased its own minimum wage to $15 in 2018. In a blog post, the company wrote, as we take steps to recover from the devastating economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, America's workers in need of a raise, small businesses that would benefit from increased spending, and the country's broad economic recovery simply can't wait. Australia's minimum wage is already at $15 US, which is 1984 Australian, but the points about workers needing a raise, small businesses needing increased spending, and the broader economic recovery needing higher wages applies just as much here. Elsewhere, the Australian Broker reported the number of businesses going into administration rose by 50% in February 2021, reversing a decline that has been ongoing for a year, according to Credit Watch's latest business risk review. That comes amid news that inquiries for credit went up by a third, indicating that while some businesses are failing, general trading conditions are getting better and the economy is rebounding after the COVID-19 slump. Credit Watch's Business Risk Review is a study that charts insolvencies, defaults, administrations and commercial debt-related court cases across Australia. While the month-on-month number looked bad, Credit Watch CEO Patrick Conlon pointed out that the total number of administrations was still lower than the corresponding month back in 2020. This is a sign of the commercial climate returning to more normal conditions, he said. The figure is likely to rise again in the coming months as JobKeeper ends and the three-month reprieve on credit arrangements for struggling smaller businesses also comes to a close. This could prompt a rash of insolvencies and subsequently redundancies, which could be destabilising on the local economy. The number of arrears and court cases related to bad debts tend to rise before insolvency numbers lift. And while there's no evidence of this yet, an increase following the end of government incentives at the end of March is a strong possibility. As for the rise in credit inquiries, Credit Watch's chief economist Harley Dale said it was largely due to the economic recovery and the willingness of businesses to move forward after the pandemic. The February credit inquiry figure is the highest monthly number since August 2020. On a quarterly basis, credit inquiries are up by 10% in the 3 months to February 2021 compared to the equivalent period 12 months ago, he said. Many businesses are ready to thrive in a post-COVID environment after becoming leaner and adapting their business models. So this is a very encouraging sign and will be essential in kickstarting a chain reaction effect across business sectors and the wider economy. But then Mortgage Business reported that arrears are likely to rise as mortgage relief periods end, according to S&P. Australian mortgage arrears are starting to rise, they said, as fiscal stimulus measures taper and mortgage relief periods end for many borrowers. But economic recovery and lower interest rates are helping, S&P has found. According to Standard & Poor's published RMBS Performance Watch, the level of mortgage arrears has begun to rise. According to their SPIN index for Australian prime mortgages, which measures the weighted average of arrears more than 30 days past due on residential mortgages, in publicly and privately rated Australian RMBS transactions, the arrears index increased to 1.37% in December 2020, compared with 1.28% in the same period a year earlier. While the index providers said it expects that COVID-19 related arrears will more meaningfully surface from the second quarter of 2021 following the expiration of mortgage deferral periods in March 2021, it notes that arrears could rise at different rates for lenders depending on restructuring arrangements and reporting nuances. Just 1.4% of total loans outstanding, or $37 billion, remained on temporary deferrals as at the 31st of January, according to the most recent data from APRA. S&P added that while arrears is rising, they've been tempered by low interest rates, a better-than-expected economic recovery and strong refinancing conditions. Strong property market performance will also help existing borrowers by enhancing their equity positions in their homes, improving their refinancing prospects, they said. This is a common way to self-manage out of arrears, they said. Arrears increases have been more pronounced in inner city areas where rental income has contracted due to population shifts in the suburbs during COVID-19 and a decline in international migration. This could change as housing affordability pressures rise, workers return to the office and international migration resumes. Higher property prices often translates to higher leverage because borrowers need to take on more debt to gain a foothold in the market. As house price growth outstrips wages growth, household debt to income ratios will come under pressure. Lower interest rates will help to offset this, but the discount underlines the importance of prudent lending standards to ensure that debt can be serviced over the life of a loan and throughout difficult economic cycles, it concluded. And the report, by the way, echoes forecasts made by Moody's last year, which also predicted a substantial rise in non-performing loans after the measure that allowed banks to treat loans subject to repayment deferrals as performing expires in March 21. And according to the Australian Broker, Australians are increasingly becoming interested in selling their homes, but they're not eager to list their properties straight away, according to the latest study by Westpac. Around a third of homeowners are eyeing to sell their homes in the next 5 years, though more than half of them are actively holding off from listing their property immediately. In fact, just 1 in 10 homeowners who are planning to sell are already in the process of putting their houses on the market in the next 12 months. Still, the level of selling intentions among Australian homeowners has increased by more than double compared to the levels seen prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. Anthony Hughes, the Managing Director of Mortgages at Westpac, said home ownership preferences had changed, encouraging more owners to sell their properties and to look for another property that suits their needs better. According to the study, 1 in 5 homeowners are selling for reasons directly related to the pandemic. A further 1 in 10 said they are looking for a dwelling that can accommodate working from home more, while a quarter are also seeking more space. Home ownership preferences have evolved since the start of the pandemic, with Australians seeking more space, peace and quiet, as well as properties which offer outdoor living like backyards and balconies, he said. And Hugh said other factors such as the low interest rate environment, upbeat consumer sentiment and improving economic outlook were supporting the stronger selling sentiment this year. Matt Hassan, this senior economist at Westpac, said the current conditions reflected a seller's market. Sales have been a big lift over the last 4 months and are up 36% from a year ago, resulting in a significant tightening in supply, with listings across the major capital cities now at a 12-year low, he said. However, Hassan believes that the situation will find its balance again in the coming months as more sellers enter the market. Demand is still expected to remain strong, driving a sustained lift in prices this year and next, he said. And Westpac has struck the latest blow in the home loan rate price war with a new offer that is the lowest available in the Australian market. The Big Four bank announced rates of just 1.79% for 2-year fixed home loans and 1.88% for 3-year fixed mortgages, which will be spread across their own brand and their subsidiaries such as St George Bank, Bank of Melbourne and Bank SA. With the Reserve Bank of Australia steadfastly keeping their rate down to 0.1% and the housing market continuing to boom, it sparked a price war within the major players in the home loan industry. NAB currently has the highest rate of the Big Four at 2.44%, with ANZ at 2.24% and CBA at 2.14%, though industry expectations are that they will now follow Westpac's lead. This is a fantastic product for a Big Four bank to come out with and will be coming up in all the searches for brokers, said one broker from Your Mortgage. It's crazy how low interest rates have got, and this is superb for consumers. This is the perfect time to get out your bank statement, check what their rate is, and then ask some hard questions of their lender. There's a good chance that the other majors will have to follow suit too. This is the second major rate cut that Westpac announced recently. Last Thursday, they dropped their GME guarantee rate to beneath 4% on unsecured fixed rates, with 3 to 5 year variable loans also falling. The rate cut will help brokers start conversations with their clients as Australia begins to move out of recession and back towards growth, albeit slowly, Westpac Business Division's Chief Executive Kumai Lumi told Australian Broker last week. If you look at what the RBA has said, low rates are essential to help our economy grow again. And over in New Zealand, the Reserve Bank there announced that it would be removing some of the temporary liquidity facilities put in place during the COVID-19 pandemic. The specific measures include the removal of the term auction facility, or the TAV, where banks have been able to borrow funds for 3, 6 and 12 months using eligible collateral, including New Zealand government securities, registered bank bills and residential mortgage-backed securities. And the removal of the corporate open market operation, the COMO, where banks have been able to borrow funds for 3 months using eligible collateral, including corporate securities and asset-backed securities. Head of Financial Markets Vanessa Rayner said financial market conditions have improved substantially since March 2020, when these facilities were introduced, and the usage of these special facilities has been very low in the last 6 months. In addition, the large-scale asset purchase, term lending facility, and funding for lending programs have resulted in a significant increase in system liquidity and a low cost of funding for banks. The Reserve Bank will continue to monitor market conditions closely and is in a position to supply liquidity as required via its daily open market operations or the reinstatement of these special facilities in the future if needed. This decision, she said, had no implications for the stance of monetary policy. And housing in Australia became less affordable in the December 2020 quarter, according to HIA, due to rising house prices and a slight fall in average incomes. Despite the decline, housing is considerably more affordable than the average over the last 20 years, stated Angela Lillycrap, HIA's economist. HIA's affordability index is calculated for each of the 8 capital cities and regional areas on a quarterly basis and takes into account the latest dwelling prices, mortgage interest rates and wage developments. Regional areas experienced a larger decline in affordability than the capital cities. The regional index fell by 3.7% in the quarter to return to the level that it was in December 2019. With the onset of COVID-19, consumer preferences have shifted towards detached houses and regional areas. Preliminary migration data shows more Australians left the capital cities in each of the first 3 quarters of 2020 than at any other time since records began in 2001. This involved an acceleration of retirement plans and fewer people moving to urban centres for work or education. The slowing in overseas migration will take a number of years to impact the detached housing market, they said. This adverse impact has also been partially offset by the return of expats, who are also seeking detached housing. As a consequence of this shift in population, house prices in regional areas outperformed the capital cities over the past year. The mismatch between the low supply of homes on the market and strong buyer demand has seen prices increase sharply over recent months. As prices continue to rise, more sellers will put their homes on the market, and this will help to keep a lid on sharp price increases which are currently occurring. It is likely that much of the shift in population will be permanent. When normal does return, however, young students and workers will once again move to employment centres in capital cities. Darwin experienced the sharpest decline in affordability during the quarter, falling from an index reading of 134.6 to 128. Despite this decline, Darwin is still considered a very affordable market. Brisbane and Adelaide followed with declines of 3.1%. Sydney continues to be the most unaffordable market, with an index reading of 66.4 in the December quarter. Melbourne is also considered an extremely unaffordable market, with an index level of 77.5. And the HIA Housing Affordability Index for the capital cities decreased by 2.5% in the December quarter, meaning affordability deteriorated. This was driven by declines in Darwin, down 4.9%, Brisbane, down 3.1%, and Adelaide, down 3.1%. Hobart and Perth both declined by 3%, followed by Canberra, down 2.8%, and Melbourne, down 1.4%. Affordability in Sydney declined by 0.8%, and regional areas declined by 3.7% over the same period. Finally, according to MPA, scrapping lending rules would inflame the housing boom, consumer groups warn. Consumer advocacy groups and some economists are sounding the alarm about a government plan to scrap responsible lending rules, saying it could throw gasoline on an already booming housing market by easing credit, while prices are already skyrocketing thanks to low interest rates. The government is planning to remove rules that make banks subject to responsible lending obligations, in a move supported by the banks, of course, but decried by consumer advocates. The government maintains that the change announced last year amid fears of a COVID-induced credit squeeze will make it easier for consumers to borrow money while still protecting vulnerable customers. Banks say that the change will allow for simpler loan applications, but with house prices growing at a breakneck clip and mortgage lending skyrocketing in recent months, consumer advocates and many economists worry that scrapping responsible lending rules will fan the flames of the housing boom. Consumer groups opposing the change on Monday wrote to the Reserve Bank Governor Philip Lowe, who also serves as the chair of the Council of Financial Regulators, urging the council to reconsider its public comments on the change in the light of significant changes in the risk environment. The council said last year that rolling back the rules would support the supply of credit and that banks would still be required to lend prudently. But Alan Kirkland, chief economist at Choice, said consumers were at greater risk from irresponsible lending during a housing boom because skyrocketing prices pressurized people to buy quickly. When you've got a hot market that buyers are desperate to get into, that places borrowers, particularly first home buyers, at risk of predatory lending, Kirkland told the Herald. Kirkland said that the consumer groups, which also included the Consumer Action Law Centre, Financial Counselling Australia and Financial Rights Legal Centre, believed that scrapping responsible lending laws would drive home prices up even further by releasing more credit into the system. It's simple economics, he said. Josh Frydenberg argued for the rollbacks and pointed to Lowe's concerns about banking becoming too risk-averse in their lending. Frydenberg said that the proposed changes would simplify the credit framework and cut red tape. The government's reforms will remove the one-size-fits-all approach, enabling the more effective flow of credit to consumers and small businesses, while also strengthening protections for higher-risk products and vulnerable consumers using those small-amount credit contracts and consumer leases, he said. However, economist Saul Eslake said that he was sceptical about the necessity of rolling back the rules. It's not at all obvious to me that there's a need for regulators to do anything to make credit more available, Eslake told the Herald. We've got 50 years of evidence that anything that allows Australians to pay more for housing results in more expensive housing. And it's worth reflecting once again that the Royal Commission into the banking sector made the clear recommendation that those responsible lending standards should stay. There is no excuse to remove them. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.